Welcome to The Book Show, and we're here with you again for a full hour this evening. So stay tuned as we bring you composer Max Richter's music inspired by Virginia Woolf. And later on, we'll hear from Paul Auster on his latest novel, 4321. We'll also be travelling the seas with Moby Dick and hearing from writer Ethel Rowan about her novel, The Weight of Him. But first, Candlestick Press's collection of poetry pamphlets encourage you to send a collection instead of a greeting card. Previous subjects have included mothers, love, chickens and bicycles. Their latest collection, 10 Poems for Ireland, is edited by Paula Meehan, and Paula joins us now from Cork with one of the contributing poets, Thomas McCarthy. So Paula, I'm guessing it must have been pretty tricky to distill the history, the mood and the words of a country down to 10 poems. So what kind of boundaries did you set yourself?
Well, when it was proposed to me, I immediately jumped at it, and then I looked over the big edge of the cliff and saw 1,000 years of literary history in both tongues. And I just thought, where do I start? But once I got Hartnett's poem, Michael Hartnett's beautiful Death of an Irish Woman, that was the starting point. And that kind of led me by the nose, really, into all the other choices. Hartnett's poem was written for his grandmother, Bridget Halpin, who taught him Irish when he was a child. He was sent out to the small holding in West Limerick, and he learned Irish from her. And that sense in the poem that she's, you know, ignorant, and she looks to all the world, she would be dismissed as ignorant. And yet she was this major culture bearer that brought the language to him, and he brought it to us. He brought it to a generation, really. So this woman is a profound influence in contemporary Irish poetry through her grandson.
Well, I think with an introduction like that, we'll have to hear the poem. So if you could read it for us, Paula, that would be great.
Death of an Irish Woman. Ignorant in the sense she ate monotonous food and thought the world was flat, and pagan in the sense she knew the things that moved at night were neither dogs nor cats, but pukas and dark-faced men, she nevertheless had fierce pride, but sentenced in the end to eat thin, diminishing porridge in a stone-cold kitchen. She clenched her brittle hands around a world she could not understand. I loved her from the day she died. She was a summer dance at the crossroads. She was a card game where a nose was broken. She was a song that nobody sings. She was a house ransacked by soldiers. She was a language seldom spoken. She was a child's purse full of useless things.
And that was Paula Meehan there reading Death of an Irish Woman by Michael Hartnett. Paula, you say in your introduction that you use Death of an Irish Woman in many settings. So what kind of reaction do people have when they hear this poem or when they read it?
Usually quite emotional. I mean, it's built to really tug at your heartstrings. Michael was a great craftsman that way. You know, most people have grandmothers and they have that relationship with that generation where story and song and different transmission can happen than with your actual parents. So it opened up these discussions around transmission, around poetry, around song, around what we value in our culture.
You could argue that it's kind of a bleak interpretation of prospects for Ireland and its language, but I know it was written at a very specific time and it's still very relevant. Do you think that the other poems in the collection have a more optimistic view of Irish life?
No, I don't think so. But I do think that all the poems I chose coming out of that situation, the Hartnett poem, they deal with historical trauma and how we survive it. And we have survived it. You know, I think the peace process in Ireland has been a profound and very moving process. So I did choose the poems that, in my estimation, made profound gestures towards understanding trauma, the trauma of our history, and towards healing that trauma. And I made it as a gesture to those coming into the island that we are a community that has come through these things. So, I mean, if there is hope in it, it is that we have survived the trauma of our history, which is recent trauma.
You also include some of your own work, Paula, which is a poem of two parts, and it's called The Two Sides of the Same Coin. The first poem is the mother tongue, and it would be great if you could read it for us.
Though there's no word for no, grant me the words for grey-hooded crow, apple orchard, child, tenement, slut, caravel, quinquereme, black-sailed boat, the far shining cities of the south.
And that was Paula Meehan reading from The Two Sides of the Same Coin. We're also joined from Cork by poet Thomas McCarthy, whose work is featured in 10 Poems for Ireland. So let's first hear a recording of Tom reading his poem, They're Going, They're Dying.
They're going, they're dying. There's a special sorrow that we reserve for parents, so deep that the world of love, the world of small happenings, of babies born and young wives undressing for a second time, cannot gain access. Philosophy itself can hardly probe so deep. Only the rain clouds bursting on mountains beyond my writing window, leaves blown against glass by the spirit of a storm, or a dog howling against the first frost of the year, can reach the subjective hollow in the head. Thus, the old impress our lives with their deaths, having borne us in pain to start the argument, and opened their love-filled hearts just too late to leave us abruptly wondering where they went.
And that was Tom McCarthy there reading They're Going, They're Dying. Thomas, thank you for that. It's the final poem in the collection and examines, as you say in the lines, the world of small happenings and the subjective hollow of the head. In this poem, I suppose you're giving us a poet's window on the world. So what was the view in 1981 when the poem was published?
Well, my view was still one completely surrounded by the sorrowful loss of both my parents, who died within 18 months of each other at the age of 55. Both of them were 55. My father died first. So I'd say at that stage I was probably still consumed by sorrow that was receding, because I had at that moment found love. So I'm kind of juxtaposing the two forms of attachment in what is a little poem. It's strange that my children are now about the age I was when I wrote it. These kind of continuing attachments in our lives, which in a way will be the sources of our major pains, that's in the poem. That effect of being alive to the world, babies born and young wives undressing for a second time, that kind of gesture of continuing birth and love.
How did people react to the poem when you published it all those years ago?
It was in a book called The Sorrow Garden. And nearly half of the poems in the book were about the deaths of both my parents. I think people were traumatised by the book, actually. I think people were actually traumatised by that book. There are people I meet even today, 35 years later, who kind of remember the effect of the book, and I have to apologise to them for it. It was just so steeped in burials and graves and grief for my lost young parents. It was just shockingly sorrowful, you know. I mean, now I'm much, much older and I'm kind of almost shocked myself at the seriousness of my young self. My God, I'd be terrified if I met my young self now.
I mean, it might have been traumatic for people around you, but and people who knew you. But certainly before I met Tom, I read this book and I recognised I was hearing the voice of my contemporary. I know it is steeped in grief, but there's a lovely eroticism in it. You know, the young wife undresses for the second time. She dresses for the second time. You know, there's a sense of that extraordinary erotic charge of the lived life, and a fantastic engagement with the natural world, with things that grow.
Well, can I ask you both, Paul and Tom, what view of Ireland would someone get if they read through this collection?
It's a very good question, and it's a very difficult question, because all of the personalities in each of the poems, you know, each personality is quite different. There's a strong sense of history, definitely, and also very private worlds as well, you know. I think there's a great comfort with intimacy, the intimacy of relationships and acceptance of the pains of attachment in all of these poems, whether they're attachment to language, attachment to grandmothers, or attachment to lost parents. I think there's an easeful power in this little book, which is the easeful power of Irish people going on?
I didn't spend days tearing my hair out. Actually, they came very easefully and gracefully up to me, these poems, and offered themselves. It felt like that.
It's also a really good idea. And I actually sent the poems to my best friend, which is a wonderful thing if you don't like sending cards. Thanks so much to Thomas McCarthy and to Paul Amin, who's the editor of 10 Poems for Ireland, which is published by Candlestick Press. Now, Moby Dick by Herman Melville is one of the great novels of the sea. Published in 1851, it's a story of Captain Ahab's obsession with the white whale, Moby Dick. Captain Ahab has lost his leg to the giant whale and he brings his crew on a whale hunt that will take them around the world and ultimately to their deaths. The novel is narrated by crew member Ishmael, and as Regan Hutchins finds out, it's a story that can leave a deep impression on its readers.
I was once in the belly of a great whale.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has you on the signal sign. Please remain in your seats.
40,000 feet above storms and oceans on my way to the other side of the world. In a massive leviathan thrashing about in the turbulent air, I opened the very first page of Moby Dick.
Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse, and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world.
Morning on Australia's Gold Coast. The ocean stretched forever ahead, bursts of frothy white water like explosions, and far, far out at sea, migrating whales breaching the surface.
There she blows! There!
Moby Dick wasn't the tale of derring do I thought it would be. I wasn't prepared for all the chapters on ropes and harpoons, blubber, botany, or the essay on the colour white. It was like an encyclopedia written by Shakespeare. But once I finished it, I began asking people everywhere, "Have you read Moby Dick?" I was kind of obsessed.
There is something mysterious about it, there is something strange about it, and there's something really Shakespearean about it, and it's very dramatic.
This is the poet Victoria Kenefick. Her collection of poems called The White Whale is a pamphlet which she wrote after the death of her father, Robert.
We lived in East Cork, and my father was a great man for Sunday drives, and I remember very much the early trips to Youghal, and my father telling me about the filming of Moby Dick, the John Huston film there, pointing out various different points of interest and where they filmed and where Huston allegedly drank and what he did and the extras that he knew and so on. And the more I responded enthusiastically to it, the taller the tales got. So in the end, it was almost like my dad was pretty much in the film.
A whale can stave in the ribs of the biggest ships, swallow whole crews, pick its teeth with the oars. Mind, lad. If God ever wanted to be a fish, he'd be a whale. Believe that, he'd be a whale.
Writer Stephen Phelan has read Moby Dick many times, and he went on a pilgrimage at the start of this year to the American town of New Bedford, where the author Herman Melville set off on his first whaling trip when he was just out of his teens.
This year's, the 21st marathon, was the first that coincided with a fairly severe blizzard.
At the Whaling Museum in the heart of the town, Stephen joined the Moby Dick Marathon. Scholars and fans gather for over 26 hours to read the entire book.
So at 3, 4 in the morning, you walk around the museum and you're seeing people asleep in almost every corner in sleeping bags, you know, face down and in open copies of Moby Dick, you know. And they've got a replica whale ship in the sort of one of the main galleries of the museum called the Lagoda. And there is a sort of night at the museum feel where people were just climbing up on deck, laying out blankets and lying there under the sails. There was this kind of slight blurring at the edge of your reality, if you like, and you do feel a little like you're sitting inside the book.
For the poet Victoria Kenefick, the association between the 1956 film version of Moby Dick and her own father's life and death developed further as she read the original book.
It's so dense and so complex, and it encourages you to question perspective, how you perceive things and symbols. And I think that quietly lay submerged, if you like, in my consciousness and in my psyche for a long time until my dad got ill. And when I tried to try and escape it on one level and to try and understand it on another, I was really surprised when suddenly out of the depths came Moby Dick.
The story is simple enough. Captain Ahab commands the Pequod, and he and the crew are off to find Moby Dick, the white whale that took Ahab's leg with it on a previous hunt. The book's narrated by Ishmael, and it's this character that gives the book its peculiarity.
We don't learn that much about his background, but he seems a fairly simple guy with perhaps some kind of melancholic tendencies and some quite narrow perspective. Something happens quite early on, which seems to have something to do with his friendship with the harpooner Queequeg, someone who's ostensibly a savage and, it's suggested, a cannibal. It seems to induce Ishmael to sort of let go of his prejudices, some of which may be social or religious. As the voyage goes on, Ishmael as a character sort of disappears, or at least he fades in and out.
Through Ishmael's often confounding digressions, Melville comments not only on the world of whaling, but on the depths of the ocean, the heavens above, and everything in between.
Though so short a period ago, not a good lifetime, the census of the buffalo in Illinois exceeded the census of men now in London. And though at the present day not one hoof or horn of them remains in all that region, and though the cause of this wondrous extermination was the spear of man, yet the far different nature of the whale hunt peremptorily forbids so inglorious an end to the Leviathan.
Ishmael is a funny one as narrators go, in that he possibly learns to reconcile himself to everything that he encounters, good and bad. I mean, there's a line in there about doubts of all things earthly and intuitions of some things heavenly, and trying to consider both with an equal eye, which I've always taken to mean not just sort of maintaining an ambivalence about existence, but achieving a kind of state of suspended judgment that Ishmael comes to operate in. To me, that always sounded kind of ideal. There's something about Ishmael that the reader might come to aspire to.
Oh, if I had the wings of a gull, me boys, I'd spread them and fly home.
And what of the white whale itself? What can this creature be taken to mean?
You could read Moby Dick as America itself. You know, Moby Dick is the dream of America. You know, beautiful, terrible, very elusive, and hard to define. There's a great line in the book that says, you know, dissect him how I may, I know him not and never will.
We begin to load that whale with our own perceptions of the book itself, but also of what we're experiencing in our own lives. So it can become a lost lover. It can become the death of a father. Once you see the whale, it's everywhere.
To venture hunting a whale.
Sometimes a whale is just a whale. What drives Captain Ahab insane, and in the end drives the crew to their deaths, is projecting their own animus, their own sense of fear or failure, onto what is effectively an innocent animal that's merely going about its own business.
I turned 40 as I read Moby Dick. I was far from home, and the world suddenly seemed to grow. Stephen Phelan felt the need to be where Melville waited for the tide to carry him out to sea, a tide which would ripple over a century later on the shore of an Irish town, reaching the grief of a young woman there.
White whale, I rattled around the back seat. Your long fingers drummed the steering wheel, out of time. In Yawl, you navigated me through Moby Dick by my miniature hand. In the pub bearing its name, Houston cursed at pints, wood-lined walls and stoop-backed regulars, imagining his just-dead father as Ahab. Peck, newly bearded, kept to himself. The harbour basin was a stand-in for New Bedford. The whale, you said, floated on drums of compressed air, hydraulics, until one choppy day, it came loose from its tow line, drifted away in a fog. They made do with a barge, concealed by hump, back, fin and tail. The captain hunted this for leagues. Your shadow haunts the water. Your finger rises to trace the crudely painted picture on the pub's gable. The creature in air and grief emerges, breaching the surface.
Victoria Kennefic's pamphlet, The White Whale, is published by the Munster Literature Centre. Stephen Phelan's essay on the Moby Dick Marathon is published in the spring 2017 issue of the Dublin Review. And the readings you heard there were from the Peninsula Arts, University of Plymouth's Moby Dick, The Big Read Project. And that's available to download at mobydickbigread.com. We're going to take a very short break now, but be sure to stay with us to hear from Paul Oster, Max Richter and Ethel Rowan. And you're very welcome back to the Book Show. Later on, we'll hear from writer Ethel Rowan and speak to composer Max Richter. But now, Paul Oster's 17th novel, 4321, revolves around Archie Ferguson, who throughout essentially four novels in one book, we follow his identical but different lives played out in parallel. So, we have four boys with the same parents, the same bodies, and the same genetic material, but each one living in a different house in a different town with his own set of circumstances. If that all sounds complicated, at least Paul Oster joins me now to explain more from a studio in London. Paul, the four versions of Ferguson that you portray in 4321 are a collection of very contradictory selves. So how did you map out the four iterations of Ferguson, if you like?
You know, it's funny. I didn't really map anything out. I just knew who they were right from the beginning. You know, I've been at this game for a long time now, and it's kind of in my body as much as in my head. And I just had the feeling that they were who they were, and I knew who they were. And each one is a bit different. They evolve differently. Number one is somewhat morose and introspective, lacking in self-confidence at times. Number two is much more of a go-getter, a tough kid, a smart kid. Number three, whose father dies when he's only seven, the boy's only seven, is the most confused, the one who gets into the most trouble, and in many ways the most lovable of the four. And the fourth Ferguson is what I think of as the angry Ferguson, the one in conflict with his father, the rigid Ferguson, the driven Ferguson. So there are differences among them, and I somehow had the feeling right from the start of the book how they were going to evolve.
So how did the process of writing it, because again there's so much going on in this book and it's a big book, did you write each event in Ferguson's life four different ways as it's presented in the book to us, or write the entire section and then start on the next one?
No, I wrote it in the order you read it in the book. First sentence, second sentence, third sentence, all the way to the last sentence of the book. I had to do it in order because I wasn't exactly sure where I was going all the time. So I had to have the accumulated past of the book at each moment in the present of the book in order to have a feeling about what the future of the book was going to be, if you understand what I'm saying.
So I'm now imagining you with a big crime scene whiteboard.
No, not at all. No. Jot down a few little things in the margin of a page, but that's about it. It's just all in my noodle, as Mozart says in Amadeus, remember that? It's all in my noggin, I think he said. It was all in my noggin.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Fergusons, because the book revolves around them and the Schneidermans, who are connected through Ferguson's mother's job. She's a photographer's assistant in the Schneiderman photo studio. And each version of Ferguson's life is not remarkably different to the other. So I'm wondering, did you resist, or why did you resist making them radically different?
Well, because they are genetically the same person. And so it would have been, I think, absurd to make the differences greater than they already are. And I didn't want to do something wild, such as, you know, send one of them off to Africa, traipsing through the jungles, and another one into outer space. It's not that kind of book. And it's mainly told from the point of view of Ferguson and his thoughts. And we're inside him, each one of the four iterations of the boy. But I didn't want to do you know, wild, improbable things. I wanted to stay very close to the ground with them.
In each of the different destinies for Ferguson, he has feelings for a girl called Amy. And in one of those versions, they have a long lasting romance. But in another, she ends up as his stepsister and his step cousin. But in the version where she eventually ends up as his stepsister, Amy actually says that she's tempted to be in love with Archie, but she's scared to ruin their friendship and maybe that he sort of feels like a brother in some way. So this is just one example in the book that gives me a sense that in our parallel lives, they can maybe help us to understand consequences or maybe see things from all angles. But what do you think?
Well, I don't think we're learning anything so much as experiencing the possibilities of a life. I've wondered about this question, you know, what if? What if I had turned left instead of right? What if I had been raised in a different town? Or what if my city had been invaded by a foreign country and we live with an occupation army? Or what if I lived through an earthquake, something like this? And you keep wondering, you wonder how things could have been different if you'd just done one small thing differently. And I think the book came out of those kinds of speculations that I've probably been making all my life.
You've also, in your own life, encountered some peculiar and probably dangerous moments, but by which, by chance, you survived. So how did some of those incidents end up in this book?
Well, I have had some weird experiences, it's true, from little things to big things. There was one thing that happened to me when I was 14. I've written about this elsewhere, but I think this was at the core of my desire to write this book. I was 14, sent to a summer camp in New York State, and about 20 boys and two counselors went off on a hike through the woods. And we got stuck in a terrible electric storm with spears of lightning shooting down around us and horrific thunder, pounding rain. And the consensus among the boys was we should get to a clearing and get away from the trees, which attract the lightning, which was the correct approach. And we did find a clearing. In order to get to it, we had to climb under a barbed wire fence, which we did single file. And the boy directly in front of me, and by directly, I mean to say his feet were about 2 inches from my forehead. When he was halfway through, under the barbed wire, lightning struck the fence, and he was electrocuted on the spot, killed. And that was probably the most important experience of my young life. Anything can happen to anybody at any time. And I've been haunted by this all my life, and I'm sure it's informed my work and how I view the world. And so this story, even though it's not told in this way in the novel, is embedded in the very heart of the book.
It absolutely sounds like it. Archie, as a figure, he's a consistently a successful writer. He does really well, and that doesn't change throughout the book. And I'm wondering, were you tempted or would it have been interesting to see him fail at this? And how might he survive if he had to do a radically different job or pick a different career?
Well, these boys are very precocious, far more precocious than I ever was, I have to say. The first one wants to be a poet, and he doesn't feel he has the stuff to do it. And it kind of dries up for him, and he drifts into journalism as an alternative, which he rather enjoys, but it's not a great passion. He winds up translating poetry, which he enjoys more in the end. Another one of them is fascinated by film and starts in very young age in high school, you know, writing articles about movies for the school paper. And number four is driven to write fiction. And we see some of his early efforts, crazy story he writes when he's 14 called Soulmates, S-O-L-E, about a pair of shoes named Hank and Frank. And that was really a challenge and a delight to work on, trying to get my head inside the mind of a smart, precocious 14-year-old boy. And what kind of story would he write? And how would I go about doing it? So one of the many challenges of writing this book.
This is a very big book, obviously, and you've always been quite a prolific writer. We spoke to Hanif Qureshi on this show a while ago, and he was saying that after his last novel, he used very colourful language, which I won't repeat here, but he said that he couldn't face pushing that something rock up that something hill again. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the idea? Again, this is quite a big and seriously committed piece of work.
Well, I can't imagine myself writing anything as long as this again, but I do want to keep writing. But I'm really hollowed out from this big work, and I haven't started anything new. I'm not even sure what it will be if and when I do start again, but I know the desire is there, and I've been in this spot many times in the past where I was uncertain about what I wanted to do next, but somehow or other, I always managed to think of something that would come to me, and I'm fully expecting something to happen.
Hanif Qureshi went back to writing film scripts, and you used to write film scripts as well.
Well, I've done a few, but always with films I was involved with, not just as a screenwriter. No, I don't really want to do that. I want to stick with my prose for the page rather than the screen.
Well, whatever it is, we look forward to it. And thanks so much for joining us on the show. Paul Auster's 4321 is published by Faber. Ethel Rowan is an Irish writer living in California. She's published a number of short story collections as well as a memoir, and her debut novel, The Weight of Him, has recently been published in the US. It's a passionate story that looks at difficult themes, including obesity, family and suicide. Here's Ethel Rowan talking frankly about her work, and she begins with a short reading from The Weight of Him.
The door to the boys' bedroom stood ajar. Billy shuffled past Michael's empty bed and opened the wardrobe, its hinges creaking. He ran his hands over the shoulders of Michael's shirts and down the empty arms. He pressed Michael's favorite gray sweatshirt to his face, breathing deep. With each passing day, Michael's earthy, almost spicy scent was fading. The Weight of Him is set in contemporary Ireland. It tells the story of the Brennan family, and in particular the father, Billy Brennan. We start the novel 5 weeks after the family have lost their son, Michael, their teenage son, he's 17, to suicide. Billy Brennan has two major challenges in life, obviously the loss of his son, but also his relationship with himself and his body. He's 400 pounds. And that's something that he really didn't pay a whole lot of attention to before Michael's death. He checked out of himself, he checked out of everything around him, really, and was living a very humdrum existence. And this tragedy shattered that false reality, if you will, that he was living under, and made him look very hard at things, in particular himself. He pushed himself in front of the full-length wardrobe mirror. His reflection appeared pale and sickly, older than 47. The man of himself was hidden behind the droop of his purple stretch-mark belly. Thanks to the press of the steering wheel, a permanent purple bruise also marked his middle, like a supersized sneer. His breasts hung larger than Trisha's. He turned away from the mirror and rushed into his clothes. What Billy sets out to do is he sets out to save others from suicide, and in particular feels compelled to save young men from suicide. And so he uses his body, what before was something that was his crux, if you will. He tries to turn that around and sets out on a public weight loss campaign to raise funds for suicide prevention. He expects everybody to think this is a brilliant plan, and he is dismayed that those closest to him, his wife, his children, his parents, and initially his community, he's from a small village in Ireland, so he has this very disorienting and upsetting response to it, but also some beautiful moments, and in particular a wonderful friendship that he forms with a co-worker, Dennis. So it's a crusade, if you will, that brings very unexpected, but I think rich responses. Billy set out from his yard, about to haul himself and his sore ankle over the 600 yards to the village. At his gate, he looked down the long road and wondered if this was all too much too soon. Dr. Shaw had said to start small and go easy. Locals drove past at speed, waving and beeping. The shock they must feel, seeing him walk to the village. He continued, his massive body going from side to side to the soundtrack in his head. Michael, Michael. When Tricia was 9, her mother died of throat cancer, and it was left to Tricia, the oldest girl, to take care of her father and 5 siblings. She'd known much more family death and broken bonds than Billy ever had. And then on top of all that, Michael. Some of my first memories are around suicide. My mother was suicidal and as a young girl would share with me that she felt life was worthless and that she wanted to end it. And I remember just being filled with terror that she would. And, you know, in bed at night, I would hear her leave her bedroom and go downstairs or go to the bathroom. And I would think, oh, you know, is this it? When I came home from school, if she wasn't there, I would also go into panic. You know, will she come home? And I myself have had my own serious struggles with anxiety and depression. And I was at one point also suicidal. And throughout my life, I very much internalized the idea of how could my mother be willing to leave me and my siblings and herself. And I wanted to offer my voice to the discussion and to the issue and the story and say, it is not any lack of love for others. It is very internal. It's very much about the self. You are in such anguish and agony, I would go so far to say, that it becomes about nothing else but about yourself. It sounds a little cliched, but I think it's true of all writers. We spend so much time with these characters. I felt enormous responsibility to tell their story to the absolute best of my ability. There was just so much to get wrong with this story. You know, a 400-pound man, in some ways, everything that I am not, and yet there's so much of me in Billy.
And thanks to Ethel Rowan, The Weight of Him will be published by Atlantic Books in June. That's music composed for Wayne McGregor's award-winning ballet Wolf Works, which was staged in London earlier this year. It's inspired by the writings of Virginia Woolf, and the three-act work focuses on 3 books by Woolf: Mrs. Dalloway, Orlando, and The Waves. The original score was composed by Max Richter, best known to many for his albums Sleep and The Blue Notebooks, and Max joins me now from London to discuss the Woolf Works projects. Max, what is it about the writings of Virginia Woolf that attracts a composer of music?
Well, I think the first thing for me was about Virginia Woolf is the extraordinary intensity of her imaginative universe. It's a very completely imagined world. And of course, every novel is dramatically different. You know, they're very distinctive worlds. I think the big sort of central theme of Virginia Woolf's writing is, you know, how do we live? How do we get through the days? And why do we do the things that we do? And I think, you know, those are universal questions. And so they're very inviting for all sorts of creative responses.
The very first thing we hear on the album is actually Virginia Woolf's voice herself, and it's the only known recording of her voice where she speaks about the words themselves.
Words, English words, are full of echoes, memories, associations, naturally. They've been out and about, on people's lips, in their houses, in the streets, in the fields, for so many centuries.
When I started to think about the composition of the work, I was sort of casting around for documentary material and, you know, expecting to find, you know, bits of writing I didn't know about or photography or that sort of stuff. And I really didn't know that there would be this recording. And what a recording. Because, you know, here is a writer talking about words. And what struck me very quickly was, you know, that she relates to words as though they are living creatures. And I think there's something very special about that. You know, that's the mind of a writer relating to her material. And that was very exciting to discover it.
One of the largest sections of the album focuses on Woolf's novel Orlando, which is a very daring book written in 1928. For those who might not be familiar with the book, can you tell me a little about the character of Orlando and the aspects of it, of that character that you focused on?
Yes, well, Orlando is a sort of marvellous kind of a fantasy, really. It's almost like a proto-sci-fi, where you have this young nobleman, noble person, who has a 400-year biography and going through all sorts of baroque sort of adventures, really, and finally coming to some sort of a resolution. And I think it's been described as a sort of almost a sci-fi novel in its kind of very freewheeling kind of structure. And for me, this evoked the idea of variations, you know, things being looked at from different perspectives. This idea of transformation, which is very central to Orlando, because Orlando goes through dramatic changes, including a change of gender. So I reached for a sort of variation form and also historical material which I could handle in the way that Woolf handles this character. So I used this piece of music, La Folia, which is a very well-known theme from 16th century Spain, and transformed it via all sorts of analog and digital means and instrumental writing, so that the musical material itself goes on a sort of historical journey, being embodied by all these different languages.
Let's listen for a moment to a track called Transformation. Max, that's quite an ecstatic piece of music, almost manic. And for you, does it describe the moment where Orlando changes sex and time? And what was it from Woolf's writing that guided your composition?
I wasn't really thinking in terms of, you know, specific bits of music speaking to specific episodes in the storytelling, because actually, you know, I want listeners to make their own connections. But what I did feel about Orlando and the sort of central image of it, really, is this sort of almost manic sort of energy it has. You know, it is very, very highly strung as a piece of writing and as a piece of imaginary sort of world building. You know, I really wanted the music to have this sense of breaking through all sorts of boundaries.
Woolf is, of course, a giant of 20th century literature. And did you have any concerns about trying to adapt her work, of how to fit the music around her words? I know you've previously done something similar with Haruki Murakami's work, but was Woolf more daunting, and what were the challenges of her work?
Every piece you make is a kind of voyage into the unknown, and that's the exciting thing. Woolf's obviously, you know, a very rich and fully imagined fictional universes are, you know, so full of material. And actually, I think of the project which Wayne and I made as a sort of voyage out into that material. And really, what is so appealing about this sort of project for me is that sense of discovering things. Composition is a lot about sort of very cerebral planning and that sort of process, but also it's about discovering things you didn't know were there. And that, I think, is the most exciting thing. You know, when you sort of, you have some material, you connect it to some other material and somehow it catches fire. That's very thrilling. And Woolf's work is, you know, full of opportunities to do that.
And I think she also does that with stream of consciousness in her writing. And I wonder, is that something you can relate to as a composer, or has there got to be a much more formal element to composition?
Well, I think composition is you know, it's a hybrid process, really. It's a process which is obviously very technical. You know, the grammar itself, the notes themselves have to relate to one another in a way which makes sense, which is kind of legible for the listener, or at least adds up to something for you. You know, we never know what the listeners think, really, but, you know, for you yourself, you know, it has to make sense in some way. But at the same time, musical material has properties. It seems to have sort of inherent properties. And I think that relates a little bit to the sort of stream of consciousness tradition within literature. Also, I think it connects to this idea of, you know, that novelists often say at a certain point the characters just start doing things which they don't necessarily expect or have planned for. And I think music has that sort of quality too. You know, at a certain point it comes alive, and that's very exciting. And then, you know, it's a question really of just kind of following that material where it wants to go.
I'm assuming that most of our Bookshow listeners will know Wolf's work, but if somebody didn't, to invest in this music and to fully appreciate it, do you have to understand the context in which Wolf worked, lived and died?
No, I don't think it's an absolute requirement, because I think these things affect us in unique ways. You know, we all bring our own reading lives and biography to this material, and, you know, everyone will have a unique response based on that. I mean, I think there are, you know, sort of contextual things within the material which relate to the novels. And obviously, you know, my intention is to in some way engage with the novels and respond to them. So, yeah, I mean, I think it would add context. But I do think, you know, music is a very direct form, and, you know, it sort of just goes in your ear and inhabits you. And I think that's one of the exciting things about it, you know, this ability for music to transport you in some way.
The album closes with the Waves Tuesday, where Gillian Anderson reads very poignantly Wolf's suicide note written to her husband Leonard. Why did you decide to include that note?
There is, you know, in the original ballet, there was a sort of spine of the biography, Wolf's biography sort of through it. And having started with this text from 1937 on craftsmanship, where she's talking about words and, you know, her toolkit really, and her language and her way of relating to literature and text, which is almost a sort of manifesto or a sort of a credo for a writer really, you know, sort of faith in words, in materials. It seemed right in a way to also show the other end of this spectrum, which is her really taking leave of language, as well as taking leave of the world, of course. It's an incredibly poignant piece of writing, and it's an incredibly insightful and literary piece of writing, because it's about her sort of separating herself from language and words and the world in this very beautiful way. And I just thought, you know, we should go that sort of full circle journey with her. And it was, it just seemed the obvious thing to do, really.
Well, Max, thank you so much for talking to us. Max's album Three Worlds is available on Deutsche Grammophon. That's it for tonight. We're at Bookshow RTE on Twitter. Thanks to all our guests, and my thanks to producer Regan Hutchins and series producer Zoe Cummins.